Hi, I'm Billy Shore. Welcome back to Add Passion and Stir. This is the conversation we love to have with people who are attacking serious and challenging problems in our society, but bringing creativity and solutions to them. I've got two wonderful guests in that regard today. One I feel like I've known for a very long time, Catherine Miller, because she was at the James Beard Foundation, which does some of the great work on chef advocacy around issues of food and hunger. And Catherine is the author of At the Table, The Chef's Guide to Advocacy. And I feel like we got to work in tandem with each other on many, many things, Catherine. So thank you for being with us today.
Total pleasure. And, you know, hunger is the gateway for most chefs getting into advocacy. It is working on the stuff that No Kid Hungry does or school meals. It's their gateway into the world. So thank you.
Well, we will get into exactly that in just a moment. And also Alicia Kennedy, who's a food and culture writer. She's got a newsletter called From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy. Alicia, I can't believe how prolific you are. In addition to your first book, No Meat Required, The Cultural History and Culinary Future of Plant-Based Eating, I think you've got another book coming out, if I'm not correct, tell me, but I think it's On Eating, The Making and Unmaking of My Appetites, which is soon to be out. And then your newsletter is just fantastic. And you're going to have to tell us how and when you write, because you write a lot and it's all great quality writing.
Oh, thank you. That means so much.
Well, I'm glad you're with us. And I heard an even better introduction of you than the one that I gave. And it came from our other guest, Catherine Miller. She said that you are the North Star in the world of getting honest about food. Can't beat that.
I do not know how to respond to all of the flattery, but thank you very much.
well, let's begin at the beginning and talk about where all of this started. And while we're on with you, Alicia, we'll start there. Just tell us about your earliest interest in food and doing the kind of writing that you're doing. Where did it begin?
Well, I had no real intention of being a food writer for a long time, but I ended up kind of running a vegan micro bakery on Long Island in my mid to late 20s. And that ended up being the way into food. But while I was running the vegan micro bakery, I was also working at New York Magazine as a copy editor. And so my work just kind of folded into each other eventually. When I closed the micro bakery, because one doesn't make a lot of money running a vegan micro bakery, I decided I could weave those two things together, the writing work and the magazine work and the food. And so I started to write about explicitly vegan small businesses, vegan artisanal small businesses, kind of using this lens that I developed as a baker, where, you know, looking at, you know, how difficult it is to sell things at a reasonable cost when you are trying to buy, you know, the fair trade sugar and chocolate and, you know, the local flour, et cetera, et cetera. And so I use that to kind of guide me as a food writer. And then I, you know, when I, at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, I was kind of losing all of my work. And I decided that it was a moment when I could kind of throw caution to the wind and do the sort of cultural criticism in food that I long to see in this forum. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 4 years.
And Catherine, you know, as I mentioned, we know each other from the great work that you've done at the James Beard Foundation and at Share Our Strength. You know, we always look with astonishment and admiration at the James Beard Foundation's Chef's Boot Camp, which indoctrinates in a very good way so many chefs in the world of policy and social change. Where did your interest in food begin, and what led you to James Beard?
Oh, it's such a great question. I mean, I've been a lifelong eater. You know, I'm sort of your typical person, right? Like just like, and not just, you know, eating for sustenance, obviously, but, you know, I just always enjoyed food. It was a gift of memory and relationship that I got from my father and my grandparents. And so, you know, it's always been top of mind. And my family owned a restaurant for about 20 plus years in the Florida Panhandle. And so I had this world of restaurants and food, but I never quite realized the intersections of food and food policy. And, you know, I was approached to, I'd spent a lifetime building a career in sort of campaigns and politics and advocacy. And two Beard, James Beard trustees, Chef Michel Nichon and Eric Kessler, approached me about designing the curriculum for the first Chef's Boot Camp for Policy and Change in 2012. And that introduced me to a whole new world, right? Beyond and everything from, you know, sort of disrupting my own ideas about celebrity chefs, which I don't love that moniker and think it's really a misnomer when we think about this advocacy work. And it also really woke me up to the idea of restaurants and chefs and even home cooks, the role that they play in culture, economies, and building those things related to food. And then particularly for chefs, cookbook writers, anybody in that sort of known public sphere of cooking, the access that they have. You know, I think as advocates and organizations, we'd spend all this time trying to think about ways to get into a congressional office or into a governor's office. And they're in every restaurant in our country almost every day. and so there's a tremendous amount of access that chefs and people in food have that just normal folks don't have. And so how could we take those things and, you know, and turn them into sort of a power for good? And then, you know, Beard is the Oscars of the food world. So if you're going to do a program like this, you should certainly do it at the place that is talking about what it means to be what it means to be the best. And, you know, part of being the best should be how you source, how you treat your people, how you show up in your community. And so, so it's been a fun journey, but, you know, lifelong food person and, you know, memories of it all. And then, you know, the benefit of being approached by Michelle and Eric, to design that first curriculum has been amazing. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so many interesting kind of, parallels in our path when you were talking about politics and campaigns. My sister Debbie and I, that's the world that we came out of when we started Share Our Strength, and we were involved in a couple unsuccessful presidential campaigns, but had the campaign organizing appetite and to some degree skill, and thought about, you know, are there unconventional places where we could bring these organizing skills to bear? And just like you, we thought of you know, not just like the usual suspects, but who are some of the unusual suspects? And we started to think about chefs and restaurateurs and the access they have and the talent and the skill they have, which they often take for granted. And next thing you know, Debbie and I and you were all organizing chefs and restaurateurs to do this work. In your case, it led to a book called At the Table, The Chef's Guide to Advocacy. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. So this is a book that's sort of the culmination of 10 years of work at the table, The Chef's Guide to Advocacy. It can sort of a book in three parts, right? It contains some of my own experiences as that sort of eater and my own observances about observations about the food system and what works and doesn't work. It's also really practical tools and tips on how to be an effective advocate. I think we all are a little burnt out of sort of the two dogs barking at each other sort of mode. And, you know, it's really a guide on how to open conversations with unlikely allies, and, you know, how to find your people in a really crowded, noisy environment. And then it's all told through the lens of success stories of chefs and farmers who have done the hard work. And I, you know, it is a bit of a call to action. People always tell me, you know, what do you want? The big question I get is, what do you want me to do? And, you know, I want us to all do the thing that feels the most natural to us, whether that's to source differently and purchase things differently, whether that's to cook differently, whether that's to, you know, organize your neighbors, whether that's to lobby. You know, there's all ways that we can be better advocates for more successful advocates for a better food system. And so it's been really exciting to see that book. And it's also just been an opportunity. And I, this is one thing that, you know, I always admire in Alicia's work too, is was an opportunity to raise some tough topics, right? One of the critiques of my book, one of an online critic or troll or something about my book was like, why is it important that you talk about the destruction of native foods and the, you know, and the destruction of bison populations. And it's because our food is some of our most political weapons. And, you know, food is so important to, you know, it dictates our survival. And there are so many policies in place that are systemic and endemic and that impact that. And so it wasn't really also an opportunity to introduce some tough topics and some tough stories and anecdotes for people to, all pun intended, chew on.
And I want to emphasize, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's got chefs in the title, Chef's Guide to Advocacy, but it's not just for chefs. All of us can benefit by reading this book and thinking about what kind of path we can take.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, your publisher, your agent always tells you, like, know your audience and who you're going to market to. And certainly the other piece of the book was a democratization of a very elite program. I love the James Beard Foundation Chef's Bootcamp for Policy and Change. It's a program that continues to this day, much with the same curriculum that I developed. And so I love that program, but that's, you know, 45 people a year. To be able to go through that program. And it has a selection process and it has all these things to it. And so this book is really a democratization of that training. And my hope is that it is for anybody who considers themselves to be a conscious eater or really interested in food systems, or just really interested in, you know, sort of how to be a more effective advocate for whatever issue that you care about.
Now, Alicia, do you see your writing taking on tough topics in the same way that Catherine does?
I mean, for me, a lot of how I write about food is about, you know, I think Catherine does work that's so important on a really tangible and material level. And I am more writing about how to change people's imaginations around food. And I don't mean imagination in like a playing, playing pretend way, but I mean in a how people, you know, interact with the notions of food that have come to be kind of calcified in their minds. Like maybe the reader who commented about Catherine's book that it doesn't really matter that we got, you know, we eradicated the bison as a political act and brought in cattle. You know, obviously because my first book is about sort of the recent history, cultural and culinary history of plant-based eating in the United States. Of course, the bison comes up a lot in my work and in my conversations. And so for me, it's about, you know, getting at the things people take for granted about food when they're sitting down to a plate or when they're at the grocery store, and trying to add some nuance and some complication into that that doesn't necessarily overwhelm a reader, but takes them to a new sort of relationship to food and where it comes from. And because, yeah, I mean, for me, it's really, I think that it's just such an important thing before you can maybe get to a point where, you know, there is real political advocacy or organization. There has to be that imaginative shift toward understanding that the way we relate to food is something that's sort of, yes, as political and also as constructed as the way we relate to anything else.
And we talk about the things we take for granted about food. Is that just about everything?
Mm. In my work, of course, it's mainly, you know, the abundance of meat and the ease of meat and the invisible nature of the animal, of the laborer at the processing center, of the ecological impacts of that meat and that and it the livestock and the processing of the livestock. And obviously for me to even talk about animals as livestock is verboten and people will get mad at me. But just to use the parlance of the industry, you know, and so the it's about especially this sort of false abundance around meat and around animal products that I'm writing about.
Yeah, no, I think we take everything related to food for granted. You know, we operate in this idea that our food should, we should be able to have anything we want whenever we want it at whatever price that we want to pay for it. And, you know, this is, it's an artificially constructed system that keeps our food affordable in certain places, right? And makes it unaffordable and unattainable in other places. And so, you know, it is such a, you know, it is the thing that, you know, it nourishes us, our bodies. It's the memories that we share. It's all the things, it's our health. It's all wrapped up into this thing. But, you know, we don't, I think writ large, people around the world don't necessarily think about all the things that go into what is on their plate and the decisions that they make. And so if you are shifting to a plant-based diet or even a more, you know, plant-forward diet, right, that is a decision, right? That is, it has implications, positive ones for the planet, for your health, for the environment. And, but I think sometimes we just think that it's all just going to magically, if we snap our fingers, it's all going to magically appear on our plate or in our pantry. And we don't think about the other things that go into it though. And we don't necessarily also think about that other people don't have the same sort of access that we do.
You just mentioned, you used the phrase, the memories that we share. And I had just read recently on Alicia's newsletter, a piece on memories as fragments. And you talked a little bit, Alicia, about different things, how food reignites memories. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'm working on a second book right now that is more memoirish in nature, but is also sort of the memoir of how I've come to think about food in the way that I do. And so I've had to reconstruct a lot of memory and try to kind of go backwards in time in my head and really figure out what, you know, because there's, I think in memoir, there's often the story that you've told yourself about your own history and the story that maybe actually was, and these have to be in conversation. And so how did I think about food? How did I think about, you know, going to Costco as a kid versus now? How do I think about grocery shopping as a kid versus now? Or, you know, what did I think about the flavors of apples as a child versus now? And so, you know, I'm trying to kind of root the memoir in different ingredients and or different foods that have been important throughout my life and throughout the geographic places that I've called home. And so, yeah, it's a really it's a difficult process to kind of reconstruct memory. But I do think that's why food memoir tends to be so kind of florid, because it does bring so much up when we taste something we haven't tasted in a long time, especially me, because I'm vegetarian now, but I was vegan for a long time. And so I got to have this kind of very unique experience, I think, of reintroducing myself to a lot of foods that I'd willingly given up for quite some time. And so I have like a very strong sense of how food can reignite memory.
And are you still in that process of reintroduction, or have you pretty much kind of caught up to what you used to eat?
Well, other than the meat, I gave up meat in 2011. So I don't eat meat now still, other than bivalves, like oysters and mussels and clams. But yeah, I've definitely pretty much caught up, but it's interesting because I do still find sort of boring cheeses interesting, you know, that like if I had become an adult while eating cheese, which really I hadn't, I probably would have moved on to far more obscure cheeses by this point. But I'm still having an enjoyable time in the world of dairy.
Before we jump into some issues around food justice and our food system, while you've got the mic, Alicia, say a little bit about your writing routine. I mentioned that I in my eyes, you're really prolific and at a very high quality of writing. Do you write every day? Do you write in the mornings? How do you manage to do everything you're doing? And do you enjoy the writing?
Oh, I love writing. I don't know what else I would do with myself. And I always wanted to be a writer. And so your food was kind of this detour that ended up the focal point. But I have a routine. The interesting thing is my newsletters, I'll have an idea, but they're written sort of in a fugue state. You know, I have an idea for how to start it, and then I write it. And then before I know it, there's, you know, 1200, 1500 words and it's done. And that's pretty much the form it'll take. And, you know, I'll tweak it and edit it before it goes out. But I'm not so, you know, I'm very attached to how they come out, but I also think part of the joy of it and part of the form of it is that it's a bit more, you know, it's a bit looser and less polished than a book would be. But right now I'm really focused on the new book. And so I am writing about, you know, I do three very, very solid hours every weekday of writing. And that's basically my routine. And I have an app on my phone that locks me out of all the social media for those 3 hours.
That sounds like a very important app.
Yeah.
Yes. It's called Opal.
I'm going to check it out. I need something that would also lock my children out and other distractions. So let's talk a little bit about food justice and food systems, which I know you're both really passionate about. One of the things I know that you spoke, and I know this because I know you spoke at Bates College because my son, Nate, is a freshman at Bates, and you were there in mid-January giving a speech about food justice. And one of the things you said there that I got to read it because you posted it was that an incredible amount of power is wrapped up in food. And although those were your words, Alicia, I would love to get both your sense and Catherine's sense of what does that mean to both of you? An incredible amount of power wrapped up in food.
Well, I mean, there's the personal power, of course, the power, you know, there's the fact of hunger being, you know, a choice that is made by powers that be. But also, you know, there's so many people who work in food, in the food system. There's so much money in the food system. There's so much corporate consolidation in the food system. And so I do think that it is an area where our sort of journalism tends to fail us because, especially in the United States, we take food for granted again, and we see food as sort of a given and an invisible thing and a thing that just sort of happens that we have to take care of. You know, there's not a lot of love for dinner. Dinner tends to be something we're like, again, I have to do this every single day. And so, and that's, you know, sort of a product, not just of culture, but also of economics and people's time and people's commute lengths and that sort of thing. And so for me, when I'm talking about there's an enormous amount of power wrapped up in the food system, what I'm saying is that these are things that should be deeply analyzed and critiqued and poked and prodded at in the same way that we, you know, we see other realms of power dissected in our journalism. You know, to go back to the idea of journalism as a public good, a public, you know, resource. And so, and I just feel like we don't see that enough. We don't see, you know, corporate power and consolidation in the food system critiqued enough. We don't see the labor conditions of the food system critiqued enough in a place that it's getting to the people. And this is me sort of paraphrasing Ruth Reichel, because I interviewed her about how she combined these things when she was the editor-in-chief of Gourmet. You know, we don't see these critiques enough in the places where people who cook are going to see them. And so we sort of let food be a trivial matter to anyone who doesn't like food. And we let food be a very, you know, exuberant sort of bourgeois, you know, fun thing to the people who do love to cook. And it is kind of both those things. It is both a trivial daily matter, and it is both a very beautiful space for expressing exuberant humanity. But at the same time, I also think, you know, there's a space where we have to actually interrogate how these foods are getting to us in a real way. And that's certainly where, you know, Catherine's work comes in.
Yeah, Catherine, talk about that, both the way power is wrapped up in food and how your work has addressed that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think a lot of us, myself included, talk about this as like a food system, right? Like and we think that everybody can see that system, but they don't, right? There's nearly 1.2 billion people around the world who are employed in some sort of food or agriculture space, right? In the US, that's, you know, anywhere from 20 to 25 million jobs that are specific to that. But we treat them all as independent little pods, right? Here, the meat processing workers are over here. The tomato folks are over here. The restaurant workers are here. The institutional food service. And so it is itself not an organized community or movement, right? And so there's a real damper on the power that all of those people have because they are purposely kept separate, right? They purposely are not really visible to one another in a meaningful way. And that is one thing that I've tried really hard to do. And I mean, for me, the chef or the restaurant owner sits at the center of that system in nearly every community in our country and around our world, right? We all have a favorite restaurant or bar that we go to. And so they become these sort of trusted places where you can have those discussions if they're willing to engage in that, right? And so, you know, it starts maybe with something that feels precious, like the farm to table movement, right? And it is moved into bigger issues around labor and tipping, wages, workforce conditions. But, you know, it's when if we can bring together that community and make those people visible to each other, there's going to be more power because food is the single subject that controls all our lives, right? It is the subject, it dictates our health. We spend most of our money on it, whether it's our groceries or our, you know, recreational. When we have access to it, we make very different decisions than when we don't have access to it, right? And so it is this controlling thing, but it's really the system is set up in a way that sort of disaggregates the power of the people who work in that community, people engage in that community. And so the thing that I just am always trying to do is make those people visible to one another, to recognize their place together in that community around food, and then figure out how they're going to move different things forward. And so when we look at whether it's, you know, campaigns for school breakfast, whether it's food as medicine, whether it's labor rights, whether it's organizing in the fields, tomato fields of Florida, like the more people that are the allies in those initiatives, the more powerful they are and the more successful they are. And so, but, you know, food is the thing. Without it, we die, and with too much of it, we might also die.
And I've read somewhere, Catherine, you saying that at first, when you first set out to organize chefs into a force on this, a lot of people thought it was kind of a ludicrous idea, I think were the words. Yeah. That, you know,
that's the clean way of putting it.
Yeah,
really.
Like how why would chefs be able to do this? But you ended up organizing them into a very effective force for advocacy and policy. What are some of the other hurdles you had to overcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few hurdles with that particular constituency of spokespeople, but also I think with even farmers or fishermen, right? One is time. When we talked about this in the beginning around celebrity chefs, right? That word just kind of makes me like choke a little because chefs are not resourced in the same way a Bruce Springsteen or a Bono or a Rihanna are for their own advocacy, right? Like they're not hundreds of people sort of serving them. And so the time and the resources that they put into this work is really limited. And I think, again, that's the same for farmers and fishermen or people who work in the food system as their bread and butter, all pun intended, right? I think the other was this idea that because chefs were sort of known, I think chefs were seen by other food justice advocates as either dilettantes or, you know, not really serious about this work, you know, they had to prove themselves. And so I think that's where the training comes in and the education, right? So they have to find the time, they have to get educated and informed. And then I think the third was, you know, is this idea that it's a long haul. all of the stuff from what Alicia's talking about and reimagining what's on our plate and reimagining the role of food in our lives to putting some of those things into concrete policies can take years, if not decades, right? And so that is the attention span of the chef community, and the attention span of all Americans is pretty limited, right? So that it was its own obstacle. But I think, you know, if anyone can figure out their own role, the time and attention that they want to put into the causes that they care about, get really informed and educated about those, and then also, you know, sort of recognize that activism takes time. And so you're going to go through a cycle on that work. I think you can be successful at it.
So Alicia, I think of in terms of what we're talking about now, I think of organizing chefs, for example, as a means to an end. I think of your writing and Catherine's writing as a means to an end. What are some other strategies that you think of that can be successful in educating and informing individuals about the range of choices they have and the consequences of their choices when it comes to food?
Well, I think for me, a lot of it is trying to get the choice aspect sort of to quiet the choice aspect, because I do think that choice can be an overwhelming thing to folks. And I think that it can, especially meaning
intimidating.
Yeah. Yes. And overwhelming. And it only speaks to a certain demographic in terms of class, you know? And so, in terms of access. And so for me, it's very much about, we can talk about choice. Choice is significant. It's, you know, I've written before that it's both over and understated as a tool in terms of how we relate to these systems and especially to the food system. But I like to kind of I think that by sort of allowing people to understand that choice is significant and they are empowered individually to make different choices that could have big impact when taken on collectively, that also the cards are stacked against them. And so, you know, because I think there's a lot of potential, and especially because I have done research around behavior and plant-based eating, when people see themselves as having, I'm doing big fat air quotes, like screwed up in terms of their consumption habits, they tend to give up and not want to make any changes whatsoever. And so for me, it's very much like, you know, this is a daily practice in making different choices and letting those choices change how we relate to other people in community ways, in political ways, in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it's not a zero sum game where you have to perform this sort of perfect choice every day, because I do find that sort of almost takes people steps backwards when they perceive themselves to have done something incorrectly.
I feel like a lot of what we're talking about, and feel free to push back if I'm on the wrong track here, but I feel like a lot of what we're talking about is in the service of advancing towards food justice. But I also feel like from this and other conversations I've had, food justice means a lot of different things to a lot of different folks.
Yeah.
What's it mean to the two of you?
Oh, that's such a great question. I mean, for me, the idea around food justice is that people have the time, resources, and information to make informed choices about the food that they eat, and that the food that they eat reflects their personal values, right? And is able to, and that feels very sort of like pie in the sky or elitist, but I think about this great example. I think about this amazing thing that happened about 20 years ago, which was a movement to get farmers markets to take SNAP benefits, right? And so that has gone through multiple iterations. It's everything from some farmers markets, you still get a disc or a certificate or a token, and some just take the EBT card, you know, via Square or whatever app. And that fundamentally changed the accessibility of fresh fruits and vegetables and other items, because those farmers markets and those community-based places, they were in the communities, right? And it took it out a little of the preciousness of, you know, a fancy farmers market. And, you know, that, but that was a structural challenge, right? And we didn't necessarily think of that as a food justice issue. But when we're returning sort of this idea of dignity, dignity and choice and information and access to food, like that for me, it all rolls up, right? Because if we're supporting those local food systems, if we're supporting those local folks, then we're most likely supporting a system where the money is staying in the community, where the benefits are better, where potentially the jobs are better, and the attitude. And it's not 100% pure, but it tends to be, you know, if you can access those things, you tend to be supporting a system that is holistically more healthy for the community in which it's based. And that to me is the thing that almost drives everything that I do.
And thank you for that. And Alicia, I'll make the question even harder for you, because when you were at Bates College, you not only spoke about food justice, you spoke about food apartheid, you spoke about food sovereignty. Tell us what you mean by all of those iterations.
Well, I see food justice as sort of the umbrella term for a perspective on food that is oriented toward a community-driven food system. And so I actually brought up my Bates lecture to quote myself, if that's okay, just because I got it right once, so I think that I should just keep saying it. But what I wrote about was food justice, that is something that seeks food sovereignty, and food sovereignty is the ability of a community to decide what it grows and how that food is, you know, distributed, whether it's exported, whether it stays within the community, what price it's sold for, et cetera, et cetera. An end to food apartheid, a food apartheid being places where access to fresh foods is lacking by determinants of demographics and economics. And the availability of specifically culturally appropriate food. And I use in my definition of food justice the concept from Dr. Hannah Garth, who is a anthropologist, of a decent meal. And so for me, food justice is not merely the ability to access fresh food. It is, as Catherine was also saying, the space, time, energy, an ability to cook it and serve it in a way that provides a nourishing, complete, and aesthetically pleasing dish according to one's cultural standards. So it encompasses quite a lot, I think, which it needs to.
Yeah. Well, that's a great definition, and actually one of the more comprehensive definitions that I've heard so far. So I'm glad you put that out there. Are there chefs, restaurateurs, other advocates in this field that you look up to, that you feel are kind of setting the gold standard or at least aspiring to? Who else do we look to, particularly as I think of as consumers who go out and make choices to eat in different places or eat different types of products? Who else should we be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many. I mean, when I think about the world of sort of food justice and tackling food apartheid, I think there are obviously some folks, I think some of you, you've had on this podcast, folks like Mavis J. Sanders, and certainly the known Indigenous chef, Sean Sermon. I also look at Rima Sill from in Oakland, who figuring out a business model that works, and the sort of also the political nature of food related to food as a weapon of war in different conflicts. And here in DC, in our own backyard, I look at chefs like Michael Raffiti, who, you know, and Amy Brandwine, and others who are really putting their dollars where it matters. So supporting local and regional food that travels in a much shorter distance, right? So supporting urban farms, rooftop garden growers, and figuring out ways to, you know, have those, because it is about the money staying within the community and growing the community, and therefore that access improves over time. And so, and there's so many more. I mean, I think if you look across your own, any city that you're in, you can find a farmer or a fisherman or a chef or a hunger advocate who is doing amazing things to shine a light on these issues. But also, and I really think this is important for the chefs and the farmers and the fishermen, is putting the money where it matters. The where they spend their money and the economic driver that they are as a collective community is tremendous. And it's probably their biggest tool that they have in their toolbox, second to their own personal voice. And I think that's true for all of us, but you know, how you spend your money on food is probably one of the most important things that you can do.
One of the things I've loved about this conversation is I feel like you're helping a lot of the Char Strength audience understand even better the connection between hunger, which has been our focus, and the larger food system and food justice issues. I know that we're getting to the end of our time here, but let me ask you both how we find out more about your work. Catherine, you were telling me, I think before we went on the air, that you've got a pretty robust schedule of appearances for the At the Table book. Is there a website where our listeners can go and find out more about what you're up to?
Yeah, no, my website is table81.com, which is the name of my business. And that's also the social media handle that I have on Instagram, X, and Threads. So people can find out book events. Also, there's a directory on that website of chefs and chef-led organizations that are working on food justice issues around the country and around the world. So it's also just a great resource. So table81, everywhere.
Excellent. And again, the book is At the Table, The Chef's Guide to Advocacy. And Alicia, give us a sense of when you're no pressure, but when is your next memoir type book coming out?
It won't be till 2026. So there is some time there. In the meantime, you can read No Meat Required, The Cultural History and Culinary Future of Plant-Based Eating, which is coming out in paperback in June.
And you know, I don't usually ask this question, but you both have so much to say that's so important. Is there anything that we just like completely missed that we should have talked about that our listeners need to know about in terms of what you're working on?
I don't have anything that they should know about that I'm working on, but my big call to action would be that everybody should register to vote and vote in November, because you couldn't have a more important election when it comes to food policy than what's happening in Congress right now and what's happening with the House and Senate. And even in state races around the country, there'll be ballot initiatives related to universal school meals and food access. And so my thing for the next couple of months is make sure you're registered to vote, go get 10 of your friends to register and make sure that you vote in November.
Boy, I could not agree more. This is, every election is important. And if you live long enough, you live through a lot of cycles of people saying this is the most important election in our lifetime. But it seems like it is. And I know from our work at Char Strength, when I think about the $29 billion authorization that Congress passed 2 Decembers ago now for summer meals and for non-congregate feeding in rural communities and a summer grocery benefit. It was passed with bipartisan support. And the fact that we had elected officials who believed in this work and were willing to put money behind it, it's going to make an enormous difference in the lives of children and families. So the direct through line between all of the things we talk about and policy and politics, whether it's in a partisan sense or in a bipartisan sense, is very real. For people. And so these elections at every level, local, state, and federal, matter enormously. And I'm really glad you put in that plug. And
can I also say that you should tell everybody to subscribe to From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy?
I was going to get to that as well, because you know, we talked about where to look for your work, and you know, From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy is a newsletter that, like, as soon as you get on the page, you just can't get off of it. Because there's just so many riveting selections there to choose from. So I've spent time on it in preparation for this conversation. And yeah, and Alicia, is there anywhere else we should be looking for you besides your excellent newsletter?
Since I'm blocking social media most of the time, no, I think that the newsletter is definitely the best place to find me.
Okay. Well, I am so grateful to both of you for taking the time. We've been talking with Alicia Kennedy and with Catherine Miller, two great authors, activists, really provocative thinkers in this space of food and food justice and food systems. So thank you so much for being with us on Ad Passion and Stir. For those who are our devoted listeners, you know that you can go to adpassionandstir.com and find all of our previous episodes. You can rate us and rank us and share with your friends. Special thanks to the team at Share Our Strength that makes the podcast possible, and especially our producer, Paul Woodall, Woody at District Productive, who has been the guiding force behind Ad Passion and Stir. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Billy Shore.